Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to composer Roberto Sierra, who is with the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. Right now, I would like to welcome Mayor of Santa Fe, David Koss. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mayor Charlotte. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you back.
Absolutely.
So, lots of things going on in the city. What, first of all, you know, you get up every day, you go to work, you do your job. What is the top priority right now on everybody's minds in the city?
The top priority? Oh, that's, you know, the city's so diverse, but, you know, I think the top priority right now is we're finishing the community convention center, we're finishing the rail yard, and we're having a great summer in between all of that with Spanish Market, Folk Art Market, Indian Market, the opera, the Chamber Music Festival, so many things going on. So and the Rail Runner. Don't forget the Rail Runner. So we have all of these three major projects kind of finishing all within the same month.
Give us an update on the convention center. When's it going to actually be ready for conventions?
Well, the first event will be my State of the City speech in the convention center, and that's August 29th, I believe.
It's going to be done by then?
No, it won't be quite done.
Okay.
But we're pushing them hard. The grand opening, though, is looking around September 12th, which is also the same time we're looking for the grand opening of the Rail Yard Park and Plaza.
Better September 12th than September 11th.
There you go. I think we're purposely avoiding those days. But we're trying to get that weekend in there, and there's discussions going on now because they're both projects are finishing so close together, and we're trying to schedule in between fiestas and all the major events. But back to the what we were talking about in the convention center, the first major conference will be the city's UNESCO Creative Cities Creative Tourism Conference that the city's been working on with UNESCO from the United Nations. We have, I think, already 250 people from around the world coming to Santa Fe to talk about how you promote tourism based on your cultures and your creativity of your communities. And so that's pretty exciting, and that'll be the first conference at the end of September.
Now, is this convention center something that can accommodate? What's the biggest convention that it can accommodate?
You know, the biggest we could have is probably around 2,000 people. I've had the opportunity to tour it twice now, once with Mayor Delgado, and then once with Governor Mora from Tizuki Pueblo, and it's beautiful. It's a great use of light and space. But the main meeting hall that we'll call the Sweeney Ballroom after the Sweeney family.
Did you make it look like a basketball gym just to bring back old memories?
No, but we can. We can make that thing look like anything now with the technology and the functionality of it. But it could seat 2,000 people for a dinner in that facility. And it's got a great kitchen. It's got other great meeting rooms that are very functional for small meetings or large meetings. A beautiful area for a visitor center. An art gallery for local artists. So it's a great building.
And so this is being marketed to the conventioneers of planet Earth.
We're marketing it all over planet Earth. We're also, though, going to have our fiesta function in there. The mayor's ball this year will be for aid and comfort. This year, the Art Commission Mayor's Choice Awards for Accomplishment in the Arts, that dinner will be at the new convention center. Next year, we're trying to have the high school prom dances and the graduations there. So
it'll be used by locals as well as everybody else.
Yeah, from Capitol High and Santa Fe High all the way through international conferences that we're having with the United Nations.
So give us an update on the rail yard.
Okay, the rail yard, you know, it's in about the same place as the convention center. The farmers market moves in August. We're very, very excited about that.
Yeah, they've been quite itinerant.
Yes, yes. They've spent, they always knew they were going to be in the rail yard, but they've been itinerant the last couple of years. But it's, I've seen the building, the plaza's coming along. That's going to be great. Warehouse 21 is already open.
Warehouse 21 is fabulous.
It's so fabulous. It's such an amazing
I was sort of thinking
job.
we would miss that old rickety building that had that had atmosphere. No, but this, they've painted it in such a way that it feels like teenagers have been there for some time.
And I wish I could tell you the name of the young artist. They did some great work on the inside and the outside of the building, but state-of-the-art for the performing arts, the visual arts, and for computer technology and graphics work. So that's exciting. REI building's coming along. The movie theaters are a little behind schedule. The park is on schedule.
Was the parking problem ever solved? Is there a big old garage where everyone's going to be able to park?
There's a huge garage. The issue has been around how much do you charge for it. So the council reached a decision where it's going to be, I think it's $1 on Saturdays to go to the farmer's market. But it's, you know, in downtown Santa Fe, parking's going to always be difficult. But we're starting to see with 400-plus spaces at the rail yard and almost 500 spaces at the Civic Center, and people just starting to ride their bikes and take the bus more.
Well, speaking of riding their bikes, that one thing that I have been slightly concerned about is it seems like with all the new street building, like Guadalupe, there's no more bike lanes. Not that there ever were great bike lanes, but whatever hope of bike lanes there were seems to have been obliterated by these medians and traffic calming devices.
I think the Guadalupe, I've heard that complaint a little bit. I think the other side of that, though, is the intention of that was to be pedestrian-friendly. And to signal to traffic that they're in a downtown pedestrian zone. So it should slow the automobiles down enough that it's safer for pedestrians and for bicycles, that there shouldn't be so many conflicts because just everybody's going slower through
it
that
It just seems like the whole traffic calming device thing where these medians with bricks and cement are in the middle of the bike lanes, whether it be on Osage or many other streets, so it's harder to ride a bike. Every time I'm about to take my bike out of the shed and dust it off, I hear of somebody else who's had a near-death experience.
Well, and actually a bike rider got a broken leg last week from somebody turning into the lane he was into. I think we're becoming more bike-friendly. We need public education, motorist awareness, enforcement by our police department. But that issue of traffic calming, narrowing the roads, they narrow the roads to slow down the cars, but it also has the effect of putting cars and bicycles closer together. I think that's a resolvable issue, but it's really more of awareness and speed. So that issue still in the neighborhoods is one that's still playing out.
Yeah.
And on Guadalupe Street as well. We're actually Roy Roth and Ken Hughes, who's on the Planning Commission, and Roy, who's doing the transit-oriented district development at ZIA Planning, and I will be attending a conference, I'm going to say July 31st in Madison, on becoming a bike-friendly city. So we hope to bring more ideas back from other progressive mayors around the country that are
So you have all sorts of contact with other cities, which is part of how you share ideas.
I've been developing those the last few years with the U.S. Conference of Mayors and now the Mayor's Innovation Project. We share ideas, and there's so many things going on in cities around
immigration
the country.
Is one of the things that you've been sharing with mayors of other cities.
Immigration is one. I took a resolution to the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Miami asking for a comprehensive immigration reform to really address the fact that we have 12 million undocumented workers, immigrants in our country that our economy needs, that our communities need, but we have an untenable situation with federal immigration law and raids and breaking up families. And I was pleased that the U.S. Conference of Mayors adopted that resolution and kind of puts the whole U.S. conference in a position of being able to help push an agenda of immigration reform.
So that body puts pressure on the U.S. Congress, essentially.
Right. Those mayors, which represent about 75% to 80% of the whole population of the United States, obviously have relationships with their congressional delegations, just like the I would or Mayor Chavez would with Senator Bingaman and Congressman Udall. And we're trying to push that agenda. We're actually pushing more money for police officers and public safety. We're pushing the U.S. Conference of Mayors came up with an idea of energy block grants, just like community development block grants, but energy block grants to help cities retrofit buildings, become more energy efficient, invest in solar and wind. And Senator Clinton and some other senators have taken that on for us. So we've got the legislation created and are now trying to get funding into that program.
Let's get an update on the Rail Runner. That's the Albuquerque-Santa Fe commuter train.
Right. It's the construction. Everybody can see the construction. They're on schedule for completion in December. So by the end of this year or early January, there'll be trains running between Santa Fe and Albuquerque, or the whole Albuquerque area.
Now, here's something I'd love to know. I like going to Albuquerque. I don't like driving. I go to Albuquerque. What do I do when I get there?
Well,
and Santa Fe. People who are commuting or just showing up to Santa Fe, they arrive somewhere. How are they going to get around?
Well, when they arrive in Santa Fe, there'll be buses and taxis around. We're adjusting our bus schedules so that we meet the Rail Runner trains. The two initial stops in Santa Fe will be at the depot, the train depot by Tomasitas, and at the Department of Transportation, very close to here. I mean, you could get off the train there and walk over to
the Santa Fe Baking Company,
say hi to Mary Charlotte,
have
some coffee. Those two stops are within a mile of 80% of the jobs in Santa Fe. So,
what about the other way around? Have you been in contact
with
the
other way around? I've just heard so far that it's working pretty well. If you want to get off in downtown Albuquerque and get to the airport, you can do that. If you want to get off and go to an Isotopes game, you can do that.
University of New Mexico?
Right. Those transit connections are developed and are being enhanced in Albuquerque. I've just heard that this morning on the radio, on the radio show. So, what I've heard from people who've used it says it's working pretty well. Not that there's more improvements we need to make. And looking at that, the city of Santa Fe and the county of Santa Fe are moving forward with a transit district, and we are going to put a question on the ballot to raise the gross receipts an eighth of a cent. And half of that money will go for our region's partnership on the Rail Runner to help with the operating and maintenance cost of the Rail Runner. That's going to be a split between us, the Middle Rio Grande local governments, and the state transportation department. And the other half of that money will go into transit enhancements to really serve the Rail Runner, so that wherever you get off of the Rail Runner in Santa Fe, you'll have ready transit connections to your final destination.
Is there any plans to work with an entrepreneur who rents out scooters or something like that?
That's actually being studied. Councillor Boucher introduced a resolution and talking about looking at short-term car rentals. We could add scooters to that. We're also looking at bike lockers at these Rail Runner stations.
Can you bring your bike on the train?
You can take your bike on the train. We've been joking about it a little bit. It's kind of one of those good problems to have in the Middle Rio Grande area where the Rail Runner's already operating. They've had to add a special car to some of the trains because so many commuters are trying to put their bikes on the train with them. And so we expect to see the same phenomenon when it comes to Santa Fe. And so we're trying to add more room on the trains for bikes, but also to have bike lockers at both locations so you know your bike's safe while you're at work or when you make the trip.
We're talking to Santa Fe Mayor David Koss. So DWI, driving while intoxicated, that's a problem that goes back to the beginning of the invention of alcohol, I guess, or the beginning of the invention of the automobile.
Yeah, I've always said, you know, the driving while intoxicated wasn't so serious when all you did was fall off your horse.
Your camel, yeah.
But when you're driving a 2,000-pound automobile 70 miles an hour, it's not good. It continues to be a serious issue for New Mexico, for Santa Fe, our police department. As you've seen us fill the vacancies in the last year and a half or so, the chief has recreated a traffic division, so people are seeing more officers out there. We're doing DWI checkpoints in conjunction with the state and the county, working on that. Continues to be an issue. Our next step, again, Councilor Boucher had passed a law, a city ordinance, where we're going to begin impounding vehicles, and you're not going to get them back until there's a breathalyzer on the car, so that we know that people aren't driving while they're intoxicated, at least in that vehicle. So, serious problem, and the statistics are coming down in New Mexico. People are finally, after 20 plus years of concerted effort, starting to change patterns a bit, but we have a lot more work to do.
Now, there's a safe ride program on weekends only.
Right, that one's sponsored by the county, and there is that safe ride program. There are the buses. I've noticed over my years of bus riding, a lot of people lose their driver's licenses over this, and then they're on the bus.
Yeah, they're on the bus. I was talking to a friend about this just a little while ago, who said, yeah, you know, the problem with DWI is everybody goes to a bar, and even the designated driver is going to drink unless they're Alcoholics Anonymous, in which case they're not going to a bar in the first place. Now, I've been to other countries, for example, Germany, where the designated driver does not drink. It doesn't happen because the laws there are so strict. You don't just lose your car. There's mandatory prison or whatever, very strong laws. What would it take to have a designated driver culture that actually functions, do you think?
Well, you know, I think it takes strong penalties, strong enforcement. It takes a lot of public education on that, and because you are talking about a cultural change where, it's part of the fun. And, when I was in Spain, it wasn't an issue in Granada because everybody just walks everywhere. And, where we can get back to just walk and don't drive a car.
Yeah, everybody walks there, but, I mean, there's long distances. Is it that the living is so much more concentrated?
It's so much more compact there, so...
So the city didn't develop in a sort of car culture environment.
Right. Yeah, in some of the entertainment venues in Santa Fe, I think it's really, really important that we develop that designated driver concept. You know, like the Santa Fe Brew Pub, wonderful to go out there. Great bands, it's a great place.
Yep.
But it's a long way out of town.
It is indeed.
And you need a designated driver when you go out there to have an evening.
That would be I, ladies and gentlemen.
Is that Mary Charlotte?
I'm going with you next time. At all times because I don't drink. But we're talking to Mayor David Costa. We've got a few minutes left. Let's talk about the Santa Fe River. I know that's one of your pet projects.
Making
it flow more than a few drops.
Right. Next Wednesday, myself and several members of the Public Utilities Committee will introduce the resolution to adopt the Santa Fe Long-Range Water Supply Plan that designates 1,000 acre-feet of city supply for a living river and makes achieving a living river a goal of our Long-Range Water Supply Plan. This was on hold for a few months because we had an appeal of our environmental impact statement regarding our Buckman Direct Diversion Project, but that's been cleared, and so we're moving forward again. My hope is that in the next year we'll be far enough along with all of our projects that long-range water supply plan will be approved by the state, and we'll be moving that way.
And we'll probably be talking about this quite a bit on this show in the months and years that come, but have the long-range plans about water taken into account global warming forecasts?
Yes, we've looked at global warming. What are the possibilities of long-term drought? That's why it's so important that we do the Buckman Direct Diversion Project. Because what we're trying to develop is a diverse portfolio of water sources so that if one is affected by drought, we'll still have one or two other sources that we can use during that drought. And then I think something long term that this region has to figure out is, you know, we don't have much evaporation when we store water in Heron or Elvado lakes, but those aren't authorized under federal legislation for water storage.
We don't have much evaporation.
No, they're very high elevation, so they're good places to store water. We store all our water in Elephant Butte Reservoir, where we evaporate over 100,000 acre feet a year. The water experts kind of joke that Elephant Butte is where we send our water to spread it out to dry, and that was appropriate in 1920, but that's something I think we need to revisit. But that's going to take an act of Congress and agreement between Texas, Mexico, New Mexico, and Colorado to achieve.
But Lots of work to do.
So our hydrologists and our water planners have looked at, you know, what when we see global warming coming, when we see a climate extreme coming, how do we handle that? And so that's in the mix as well.
David Koss is the mayor of Santa Fe, and I want to thank you so much for being with us and hope you come back to the show soon.
Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome composer Roberto Sierra. His Concerto de Cámara will be performed tonight at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art in Santa Fe, and that's at 6 o'clock. And at 5 o'clock, there will be a pre-concert talk with Roberto Sierra and Mark Nykrug. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And we're also joined by Steve Novitsky, who's the executive director of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. Great to have you.
It's great to be back.
So this piece is a commissioned piece, co-commissioned by the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival and another festival for string quartet and woodwind quintet. How did this combination of instruments come about?
It was not my original idea to do it for this combination. And the interesting part is that these are two quintessentially known ensembles with a great traditional repertoire. But for some reason, they are seldomly put together to play as an onet. So, you know, I have written a wind quintet. I have written a string quartet. And when I got an email, I think it was, now everything is done through email, actually, from Valerie Coleman from the Imani Winds, whether I was interested in writing a piece for this combination, I was immediately intrigued and excited about it. And what was peculiar is that I thought, gee, I will go out and find out the wealth of repertoire that must exist for this combination. I was surprised about the fact that there is very little written for these two ensembles together. So that's how the idea germinated. And I think after that, then the next step is to find the venues to play and the venues who will actually, pay and sponsor this endeavor. And this is where Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival and Steve Ovitsky, whom actually I have known now for a very long time. We go back 20 years or more. We were very small children.
We were very young.
And this is so it's a complicated process of many layers, but I'll let Steve talk more about it.
Well, what happened one day, Mark Nykrug and I were talking about composers to commission. And Mark, as the artistic director of the festival, is the one who makes the choice of a composer that will commission. And he mentioned to me that he had received a phone call from the manager of both Imani Winds and the Miami String Quartet about would we be interested in becoming part of a consortium or leading a consortium of festivals commissioning Roberto to write a piece for these two ensembles together. We had already engaged the Miami String Quartet for this season. So we looked at each other and said, yeah, let's do it. So the first thing was to find some other partners. And Chamber Music Northwest, who is a regular partner of our festival and commissioning works, was very interested in becoming part of it. And then Stanford Lively Arts at Stanford University was the third member of our consortium.
And so not only do you have partnerships in commissioning the works, but then the works get to be heard more.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about consortium commissions, and I know you've done quite a few of those.
It's actually more and more common because it works for everybody. I mean, you have more exposure. It's also more interesting for Santa Fe to have involved other prestigious music festivals. You know, this is. I mean, your audience should know that the Santa Fe Music Festival is one of the premier chamber music festivals of the world. But there are other festivals that are also very important. So it makes it into a much more interesting, engaging endeavor. And of course, the composer is having a dream fulfilled because you will not have one performance, but three performances of the same piece.
And then more people hear it, and with any luck, it goes into the repertoire, and then more people play it.
Exactly. You sort of throw a wider net.
Well, in the case of this piece, of the Concierto de Camera, it was played in Portland last week. Mm-hmm. As I've mentioned to you before, Mary Charlotte, sometimes when we co-commission works, one of the other co-commissioners gets the world premiere because of timing, and we try to split those around so that we're all equal partners in a co-commission. And so last week was played how many times?
Last week was played two times.
Two times. This week it's being played two times. It will be played again at Stanford University. So within a period of a few months, there will have been five performances of this work.
That's right.
And then on top of that, now both of the ensembles have it in their repertoire. And then when they get engaged for other concerts, they'll program it again.
And then they, either the woodwind group or the string quartet, can invite another quartet or quintet
exactly.
to work together. Have you witnessed the rehearsal process where these two groups come together?
Yes, I did. I was there at the when I came to Oregon, to Portland, and of course you come with trepidation because you're always hoping that everything works and that there are no embarrassing moments of really messy parts and that. But I wasn't so worried about the parts because I supervised them myself. I was more worried, and I was telling Steve yesterday that one of the very first things that came through an email was a question, well, this should not be a piece that needs to be conducted. Because, I mean, you're talking about a larger ensemble, and Steve was concerned about that as he needed to be, because, you know, otherwise it's not really that chamberish anymore. It becomes more like a little orchestra. And that was one of my fears is to put two ensembles together and whether they could play it without needing somebody there at the podium. And from the first rehearsal, it was clear that they could do it. I mean, of course, we are dealing here with two amazing ensembles. I mean, the Miami String Quartet is phenomenal and the Money Winds is also fantastic. So it was a very smooth sailing and I was very relieved.
Now, the Imani Winds have the distinction of being an African-American woodwind quartet.
Quintet.
Unusual in classical music.
Yes, but, you know, when I look at them, when I hear them, I think the beauty of that ensemble is that they are at the top of their game, so they're just a first-class woodwind quintet that happens to include a contingent of African American players, and I think in a way, you know, it transcends that aspect. But of course, on the other hand, it's very important for them the ethnic aspect, and they sort of foster that notion by the Legacy Project and the concert, for example, last night, a beautiful concert of Afro-Caribbean and African-American music, which was fantastic. I mean, the audience was elated with
and
them.
And they arrange a number of pieces for themselves based on African music or Afro-Caribbean music.
We're going to hear now a piece from Concierto de Camera.
Thank you.
So now I'm going to ask you some very naive questions that only a non-musician, non-composer can ask. When you are composing a piece like this for nine instruments, strings and winds, do you hear it in your head? Do you do all your composition like that? Or are you also playing yourself? Do you play an instrument while you're composing?
Yes, I am a pianist by training, and that's my instrument. And it is indeed in my head, but I need the tactile sense of the music because it's the way in which I can put myself in the place of the performer, which I think is very important for pieces to work well. If you think of the repertoire of the past, except Hector Berlioz, who played the guitar, everybody else played an instrument in a very professional manner. I mean, you think of Beethoven. Well, Beethoven was a composer, but he was also a phenomenal pianist. So, and to me, that's important, that physical, tactile connection to the music.
And so how do you compose differently based on what the instruments are? I mean, you've composed pieces for saxophone, for winds, for all sorts of things.
You have to transcend matter. You have to to understand the idiom virtually. You have to have an inner sense that when you are writing a line for the saxophone or for the violin, you're imagining, even if you're playing it at the keyboard, that sound has that idiom, has the breath or the friction of the bow. All of that has to be in the mind of the composer in order to work right. Because these are very intricate and specific instruments with their own centuries-old mannerisms.
And so when you're composing, for example, for an instrument that has a lot of jazz repertoire behind it, are you more likely to use jazz kinds of rhythms?
Absolutely, and that was the case in point with my saxophone concerto for James Carter. The popular tradition that are very familiar to me, of course, is the Afro-Caribbean, Puerto Rico, you know, salsa is, as I always joke, you know, you go to the streets and you hear salsa, even if you don't want to hear salsa because somebody is playing it very loudly, very near. But jazz was in the background, and of course there is a lot of jazz influence in salsa, we know, but the pure jazz American idiom was not so familiar to me. So when writing the concerto, I did listen to a lot of jazz, you know, to infuse myself again with those idioms, and I use the word mannerisms in a positive way. These are ways in which players have come to learn those instruments and come to bring them to life through their music, and they infuse them with a particular language that I think one ought to know if one is writing with a specific player in mind like James Carter.
Now, unless I'm wrong, I mean, I've heard some of your music. I certainly haven't heard all of your music, but there's not so much of the Puerto Rican salsa tropical influence as one might think.
It's hidden always. I don't like to make it. I mean, I don't write popular music. That's clear. For that, you have the salsa groups. But for example, in the piece you're going to listen, the concert tonight, you will hear in the last movement a very clear signal of some rhythmic structures that are actually born out of salsa music. And the way I explain this is that this is actually not a new procedure. I think a lot of the music of the past, take Beethoven or Mozart, is infused with popular idioms. It's just that we don't hear them as popular idioms anymore, and they were structured within a larger symphonic language. And it's so in a way that's what I do. I take these idioms, these rhythms, and bring them to a different, and morph them into a different medium and put them into a different structure.
In the art world, there are women who don't like being called women artists. They just want to be called artists. Does that work the same? You know, maybe you don't want to be called a Caribbean composer, but just a classical composer.
I cannot control what people call me. In fact, I am a Caribbean composer. That's
right.
However, for how many years have you been living in upstate New York?
Oh my God! Let's say the United States. I came here in '89, and at some point I would have been living more here than in Puerto Rico.
But in Ithaca.
In Ithaca is already 92 till now.
Yeah.
So,
and you're a professor at Cornell.
I'm professor at Cornell. So it is funny. It's inevitable. You know, we are what we are. We are who we are. And people will call whatever they want to call. But as long as one is clear and in his or her own mind of what one is, then not an issue.
We're talking to composer Roberto Sierra. So, what is it like, and here's another, you know, naive question, but to be composing classical music today when it's not really mainstream as it would have been in the day of Mozart or Beethoven, and also in the circles in which it is mainstream, there are people who want just to listen to Beethoven and Mozart.
That's a very, very interesting question that can have a very long discussion. When you say mainstream in the time of Beethoven, who was the mainstream at that time? Was it the Palace of Lobkowitz and Waldstein? Let me tell you the what I think is the opposite of that. I think more people now listen to classical music, even percentually, than ever. I think we would be surprised if we had statistics. I mean, a lot of people in Vienna knew who Beethoven was because he was a prominent figure. But a lot of the pieces by Beethoven were heard in very small circles, actually much, much smaller than the circles that hear Beethoven's music now percentually. So I don't know. I think that there is a lot of mythology in assessing these things.
What do you mean?
I think that we have come to believe that the past is something that it wasn't and that the present is something that it is not.
So the past was this time where everybody, well, of course, it's the aristocratic
not every,
class.
Yeah, not all the aristocrats were listening to Beethoven either.
Right, right.
Listen, people are people always. There's no difference. They wore powder wigs, but the amount of people who would have listened. I mean, a lot of Beethoven sonatas, again, or string quartets were heard in small rooms in a private house.
Yeah, rarely would you have heard chamber music with an audience of 400 people like we have in St. Francis Auditorium.
Yeah. Right. Well, and also, I mean, we have a world in which there's live music, there's radio, and there's recorded music.
So more people are listening to Beethoven now than ever, even proportionally. I'm of course, not numerically, absolutely, but even proportionally, I don't have the statistics, but I have a certainty about this.
So what is the classical music composer's world like today? I mean, what is your life like in this larger community?
It's very interesting. I mean, I always say I'm a composer because I have to be a composer. So, and it's a wonderful thing to do something creative and to see it realized. Be that music, painting, literature. It's an amazing feeling and a scary one, of course. And I think that if I look historically, I think there's so many wonderful opportunities for composers nowadays, and there is a lot of openness, specifically in the present day. I mean, you have Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. I was looking at their program and their history of commissions. It's amazing. Within the span of a summer festival, the amount of works that Santa Fe has been responsible for creating. So there are venues out there that help us to bring this music to life.
When I was listening to your music, I thought a lot of Stravinsky and I thought a lot mm-hmm. of Gershwin. And I wondered if either or both of those composers were big influences on you.
Stravinsky certainly, and Gershwin perhaps in the sense of using popular idioms within my own language. But Stravinsky, is central and seminal to the 20th century and still to the 21st century. I think it's one of those composers that you cannot escape.
I was listening to a radio program once, and they were interviewing an author, and she said, the way that I can write about the place I came from is living very far away from it and looking back and thinking in my memory. And then there are other authors who can only write if they're absolutely immersed in the place that they're writing about. And I wondered if there's any analogy musically. Like, do you have to get immersed in a kind of music in order to be composing in that way?
I think because of the abstract nature of music, I mean, if you are writing a novel, I can see that viewpoint very clearly. But music is rather abstract. The only thing I can say is that, indeed, I look at Puerto Rico, which is where I was born, in a different way that I look at it when I was living there. And the same for Europe. I lived in Europe 6 years. I look at Europe very differently now from... So you... Distance times gives you a different perspective. And those perspectives come into play into what you create.
How do you look at Puerto Rico differently?
Perhaps more objectively and with less leniency at times.
I really would like to know what you mean by that.
Oh, this is too long for this radio program. No, I think when you're living somewhere, let's say in Santa Fe, You're living in it, your family's there, and, you know, you have a perspective tied very much to the currents of the place. When you leave that place, I mean, there is a sense of separation, and I think there is also a certain degree of objectivity that distance, both physical distance and distance in time, creates. It's a natural process. It's like your children, you know. It's like when they grow up and when they are not living with you, you look at them differently as when they were little children.
So we're coming to the end of our time together. We're going to go out with some music from Roberto Sierra, and there's a piece called Folias, played by Manuel Barueco on guitar. Tell us about this piece.
The piece is based on a very... this is something that Steve and I have in common. We love old music, and we also love Sephardic music, the sort of the Jewish tradition from the Spanish diaspora. So I'm always interested in music that goes back way, way back. And there is a tune and a harmonic sequence called La Folia de España, which the histories are very murky, because some people say it was in Mexico and then from Mexico came to Portugal and then from Portugal to Spain. So there are many versions of where La Folia comes from. But it is once you hear it, you recognize it, because it's a lot of composers, including Rachmaninoff, you know, have dealt with La Folia. And Corelli, and you name it. I mean, there are variations on La Folia galore. So this is yet another set of variations on La Folia de España, and I call it Folias, to give it a different twist. And this was written for Manuel Barrueco, who is a Cuban, an amazing Cuban guitarist, with the Orchestra of Galicia, conducted by Victor Pablo Pérez. And it happens that October 4th and 5th, Manuel will be here in New Mexico with Las Cruces Symphony, playing the same piece.
So, lucky you get to choose the guitarists for whom you write.
Yes, I mean, and I, with Manuel, you don't need any other guitarist.
No, he's wonderful. And just one more reminder that tonight will be the final performance of Roberto's Concierto de Camera with Imani Winds and the Miami String Quartet at St. Francis Auditorium as part of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival.
And that's at 6 o'clock. And at 5 o'clock, from 5 to 5:30, there will be a pre-concert talk with Roberto Sierra and Mark Nykrug.
Actually, I'll be doing that talk. Mark had to had another appointment, so Roberto and I will be doing the talk tonight. For information about tonight's concert, you can call 982-1890 or go to the festival's website, www.santafechambermusic.com.
And that is the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, of which Steven Ovitzky is the executive director. And Roberto Sierra, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me here. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Colors of Jazz. Thank you.